Enron was truly a trial of the century. It had everything: massive egos, bigger-than-life lawyers, and a massive fraud. On this special series from the Compliance Podcast Network, Tom Fox is joined by Lauren Steffi, who was a business journalist while it was all happening. Tune in for his reflections and new insights on the first trial of the century for the 21st century.
This is Tom Fox. I hope you will join me for our fifth and final episode in our five-part podcast series, The Enron Trial, where together with former Houston Chronicle business columnist Lauren Steffi, we reflect on the Enron trial, its legacy, what it means for the legal system, and what it meant for corporate governance going forward. In episode five, we take a look at some of the legacy items, why we should remember it, how it led to the passing of Sarbanes-Oxley, how does it stand up 15 years later, what perspective does it put other corporate frauds in, and how Lauren was able to weave this into his latest work of fiction. I know you'll enjoy this series, and I know you will enjoy our concluding episode five on Enron's legacy.
Hello, everyone. This is Tom Fox, back with Lauren Steffi for our fifth and final episode of Enron, the Trial. Today, we're going to take a look at Enron's legacy. This is the 20th anniversary of the collapse of Enron, and there's been a lot of commentary about that, but I was particularly interested in the trial, which led me to ask Lauren if he would do this podcast series with me. So, Lauren, let me start by asking you, why should we remember Enron? But more importantly, why should we remember the trial?
You know, I think that both the trial and the company's legacy itself, the collapse of Enron, are a cautionary tale. I know that Enron is studied in business schools today, but I think that what the trial really brought home for everyone was the human toll that these kinds of corporate malfeasance cases can have. When companies play games, when they misrepresent themselves, when they try to do whatever is necessary to keep their stock price up at all costs, there's a lot of long-term harm that comes out of that. You know, there are thousands of people that lost their jobs at Enron and you know, right before Christmas. And it took many, many years for their retirement accounts to recover, for their finances to recover. And many probably are still feeling that cost. And so it's an important thing to keep in mind. And I think it's something that perhaps doesn't get focused on as much in business school. This wasn't just an accounting case. I mean, I always say, you know, Enron wasn't, yes, it was an accounting failure. Yes, it was a corporate governance failure. But above all else, it was a human failure. And we need to remember that these kinds of things have consequences.
You alluded to one of the innovations of Enron in an earlier episode, and I want to maybe pick up on some of the innovations. And it was around a innovation to partner with then the leading VHS renter Blockbuster to provide on-demand videos. Now we call that streaming. And this was over 20 years ago. And it's a way to introduce, actually, there was a lot of innovation at Enron. There was this online streaming. There was broadband market. They were going to try to do a similar market with water and other commodities. But they got caught up in this accounting fraud. But could you give us a few words about the innovations you saw from the business perspective?
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, the fraud of Enron kind of overshadows a lot of the things the company was trying to do. I mean, this was a company that wanted to hire the best and the smartest people in the world. And they had a fair amount of success doing that. And so while, you know, Andy Fastow and Jeff Skilling were, you know, cooking up their schemes, there were a lot of people that were working hard on the technology front, on the, you know, sort of market innovation front, to come up with all kinds of innovative things that we today take for granted. And certainly streaming video was something they were way out in front on. And you have to wonder if Enron hadn't cooked the books, if they had accounted for it properly, would they have become Netflix? But it wasn't just that. Another one that often gets overlooked is weather derivatives, which are a kind of esoteric financial instrument, but it basically allows you know, ski resorts and any kind of business that's dependent on the weather to hedge their costs if they have a bad season. So it's brought a lot of financial stability to weather-dependent industries in a way that we didn't have 25 years ago even. You know, that has affected agriculture, you know, obviously leisure, you know, all kinds of things. And so That's another big one that, you know, we tend to forget about. It's sort of more of a behind the scenes thing, but it was very important. You know, and a lot of the things they did in the power market. I mean, keep in mind, Enron was a big believer in renewable energy. They were an early investor in wind farms, and some of their wind farms are still in operation in the Texas Panhandle. So they really were out in front of a lot of these trends. Unfortunately, they, you know, shot themselves in the foot with their accounting.
Enron had other lasting legacies. Together with WorldCom, they really led to the passage of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, which is a major change in how U.S. government looked at accounting issues and potential accounting fraud. But I was wondering if you might talk about some other major corporate frauds and put Enron in perspective with those.
Yeah, I mean, Enron kind of stands alone because in many ways it was the biggest, not necessarily in terms of dollar amounts, but it was certainly the biggest at the time. But it was such a large company and it fell apart so quickly. And it was kind of the first, right? But yeah, we had others that came after. WorldCom was, you know, one that actually wound up being a bigger bankruptcy than Enron. The difference with WorldCom was that it was basically two guys at the top that were playing, you know, financial games and that were trying to take money out of the company for their own benefit. Whereas, and the thing I always point out about WorldCom was, at WorldCom, the internal controls worked. The whole reason that the fraud went on as long as it did was because Bernie Ebbers, the CEO, kept giving the internal accountants, the internal auditors, special assignment projects to divert their attention so they wouldn't see what was happening. Once the auditors actually got back to doing their jobs and saw what was happening, they blew the whistle on him. And so, you know, whereas with Enron, a lot of the internal controls guys, the risk management people and stuff, were, with a few very big exceptions, who, you know, there were people that definitely raised the flag that things were not right, but they were kind of drowned out and pushed aside, and Skilling would berate them and say, oh, you don't get it. That was always the big thing in there. You don't get it. You're not. And so, you know, a lot of the internal controls were sort of corrupted at Enron. And that kind of gets into this idea that we talked about before, that it was a much bigger fraud in the sense that you had a lot of buy-in from a lot of people who would not normally go along with something like
that. Let me pick up on a point you raised, which was blowing the whistle. And Enron had one of the most famous whistleblowers, Sharon Watkins. And Sharon's blowing the whistle was internal. It was directly to Ken Lay. It laid out her concerns. But Sharon really created a class of people that Sarbanes-Oxley protected in its law, Dodd-Frank. Whistleblowing was enshrined. And now bounties are paid by the Securities and Exchange Commission for whistleblowers who step forward with instances of criminal activity under the Securities and Exchange Act. Could you give a few words about Sharon Watkins, her role in this, and maybe the legacy you see in her role as a whistleblower?
Yeah, I think if Sharon were on this podcast, she would be the first one to point out that she was not technically a whistleblower as it's typically defined. She did raise concerns. She went directly to Ken Lay. And you have to keep in mind the culture of Enron. You know, Skilling had left. Lay had come back in. A lot of people believed that Skilling was the problem. A lot of people within Enron thought that he was the one that had steered the company wrong. And Lay was the kindly grandfather who loved the company, had founded the company, and he was going to fix it all. And so she went to Lay thinking that he doesn't really understand the full extent of what's going on here. And so once I tell him, then he's going to fix it. Well, he did understand what was going on, and he had no intention of fixing it. Well, at that point, there probably wasn't a whole lot he could do to fix it. So her warning kind of fell on deaf ears, but the memo wound up coming out in the congressional investigation that followed when they collected all the records, the internal records from Enron. A congressional investigator found her memo, and that's what led her to, you know, then she testified before Congress, and she kind of got held up as the person who tried to warn about what was happening. And there were others within Enron as well that had tried to do various things, but you know, I think what it showed us was that anytime you have a fraud of this scale, there's always people that saw what was coming and tried to do the right thing. And you're right, Sarbanes-Oxley and some of the laws that came after that tried to help these people, because one of the problems in the corporate world is that if you blow the whistle like this, you're never going to get another job again. Even if it's the right thing, even if the company was doing things wrong, you know, you're seen as a snitch and you're seen as a kind of a troublemaker. And most companies don't want somebody like that in their ranks. And so, you know, the one thing, I mean, I've talked to a lot of whistleblowers over the years, and the one thing they all tell you is, you know, yeah, it's, you know, once you do this, you're done, right? So the bounty program, as you call it, is really kind of designed to recognize that financial loss. I mean, there is a benefit to all of us as investors, as members of society. You know, we want businesses to operate honestly. We want them to follow the rules. The rules are designed to, you know, make sure the playing fields are leveled. And so if for all of that to happen, we need people who are willing to speak up. And if they have to sacrifice their, you know, their financial futures, they are less likely to do so. And so the whole law is kind of designed to take the edge off of that, I guess, if you will.
Lauren, in thinking about the tale of Enron, the story that resonates the most with me is Icarus and Daedalus. Although some have told me, no, Tom, this goes back to Abraham. But wherever you think this tale may have its origins, you've actually used this tale in telling a story. So I was wondering if you could tell us about your writing and using the tale of Enron, how you incorporated that into a recent book.
Well, it's funny, you know, I've been working on a novel kind of on and off for years. As many journalists, I had a novel in the drawer, right? And I started working on it, gosh, probably in the mid-90s, long before Enron happened. You know, I was kind of getting it ready. I decided I was going to publish it. It actually came out in the spring of 2021. And the book's called The Big Empty. And it really has nothing to do with Enron, except that at one point, I was talking with my editor about the premise of the book is that a high-tech semiconductor plant moves into a small town in West Texas, and there's kind of a culture clash that ensues. And I was talking with my editor, and she said, well, you know, the guy who was head of the plant, like you want the characters to kind of come together in some way, or at least have some sort of understanding of each other. And she felt like he needed more motivation for this kind of change of heart that he undergoes. And I sort of realized that because the book was set in 1999 for several other reasons, it was the perfect time. It sort of coincided with what happened at Enron. And so I don't want to give too much away, but I'll say that there's sort of an Enron-esque component to this one part of the book, to what happens there. And I kind of enjoyed writing it because it was as if you knew Enron was going to happen, but, you know, the characters in the book have no idea. And so you could kind of deal with what they're thinking and their emotions. And it sort of allowed me to revisit some of those early things about Enron. Like I said, it was such a big company, and its collapse just so completely shocked everyone. No one thought that this could happen to one of the largest companies in America.
You know, after listening to that description, I might suggest you send a copy of that book to every current resident of Taylor, Texas, for what they're about to be in for.
You know, I got to tell you, Samsung did me a favor because there are some similarities.
Well, Lauren, I wanted to end this podcast and this podcast series by asking you 15 years later, after the trial, what do you really see as the legacy of the trial, or how should we think about it today?
I think that we have come to view corporate responsibility differently. I think you can draw a direct line between, you know, what happened at Enron and some of the sort of activist investor ESG types of initiatives that you're seeing now. We have much more focus on corporate governance. It's not just about shareholder value anymore, right? We're not just about making money for investors at all costs. We've kind of realized that our corporations have greater responsibilities than that. They have responsibilities to their employees. They have responsibilities to their communities. And I think many, many companies are much more focused on that than they were. And that's a good thing for everybody.
Lauren, this has been a great pleasure for me to visit with you about this. I hope you've enjoyed sort of revisiting many of your prior columns and thinking about this in a way you hadn't done in a long time. So I wanted to say thank you for taking part in this podcast series.
No, thank you, Tom. It's been a lot of fun. I've enjoyed it.
The fifth and concluding episode of the podcast series, The Trial of the Century, the Enron Trial, Lauren, Steffi, and I took a step back and looked at some of the legacies from the Enron collapse, the story of Enron, and the Enron trial. From the trial, we certainly saw the human toll of what happens when senior management engages in fraud and corruption. Clearly, Ken Lay and Jeff Skilling, and indeed the entire senior management team at Enron, was involved in the fraud, and it literally destroyed the financial lives of thousands of Enron employees and many other Enron shareholders. This was not the case of one bad apple or one failure in internal controls. This was corruption through accounting fraud, literally at the entire senior management rank. It was men, and they were men, who wanted to maintain the share price at all costs, and they engaged in fraud and accounting fraud to do so. But legacy, the broader legacy of Enron is much different, I think. Certainly, the accounting fraud is the overshadowing legacy of Enron, but it was also very innovative. It was innovative at the time they created the gas trading market. It was innovative 25 or 15 years before Netflix. Enron had entered into a partnership with Blockbuster to live stream videos. So that's called streaming today, and Enron was doing it 20 years ago. Unfortunately, the partnership didn't last, and it didn't work out. And Netflix came along, but imagine what Enron had in 2000 when it developed its partnership, 1999 and 2000 when it developed its partnership with then the leading VHS renter, Blockbuster. Also, weather derivatives. Weather derivatives allow resorts and other locations dependent on the weather to hedge against catastrophic weather failures, whether that be a snowstorm, a no snowstorm, a flood, a fire, or other events. And in this age of climate change, that's become very important as a risk management tool. Also, Enron heavily invested in wind power, and certainly in the state of Texas was really one of the first major corporations to do so. Once again, showing a forward vision that was lacking in many companies. It really was a legacy of innovation, once again, unfortunately, overshadowed by their accounting fraud. Another legacy of Enron was Sarbanes-Oxley. And Sarbanes-Oxley was passed together with Enron. WorldCom failed shortly after Enron, and that led directly to the passage of Sarbanes-Oxley, even though the frauds were a little bit different in both companies. Enron, in perspective, shows what can happen when you have a truly corrupt culture. And Ken Lay fostered and created a corrupt culture that Jeff Skilling then followed with in his short tenure as CEO. But as COO, he certainly fully embraced that get your numbers at all cost. And that came out in the trial. The most lasting impact from Enron will be probably the change in the way we view corporate responsibility and corporate governance. I mentioned Sarbanes-Oxley and the focus on certification of accounting results, literally all the way through an organization up to and including the CEO. Well, I think you can draw a direct line from Enron to today's ESG, particularly the G in ESG, which is corporate governance. Corporate governance changed just as corporations have changed away from the Milton Friedman shareholder-centric model to the Business Roundtable's statement on the purpose of a corporation, which articulated at least five different stakeholders within an organization. All of these are outgrowths, I think, directly from Enron and the legal and business response to Enron. I hope you've enjoyed this five-part series on the trial of the century, Enron. Lauren, Steffi, and I had great fun doing it, and I hope you'll join us again on the Compliance Podcast Network for our next special series.